So you're hip to multiple facts about breastfeeding. But did you know that as soon as a mother picks up a toy at her child's daycare, her body begins to make breast milk with antibodies that protect her baby from germs living on that toy? Join me, Corinne Fregoni, in a conversation with Dr. Anne Eglash, family doctor and lactation consultant, about the wonder and challenges of breastfeeding. Stay tuned to Through the Eyes of Women. Welcome to Through the Eyes of Women, a program featuring the lives and perspectives of women, local, national, and international. Dr. Anne Eglash is a family physician who coincidentally lives and works in the state of Derry, Wisconsin. I don't think I could ask to talk to anyone who is more knowledgeable than Anne about breastfeeding. She is an amazing resource for health professionals and, more importantly, mothers who come from as far away as North Carolina and New York to seek her care and help with breastfeeding. She's a clinical professor with the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine, co-founder of the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine. She co-hosts and produces a free breastfeeding medicine podcast series, and along with her husband has created a nonprofit organization to promote and support breastfeeding for families called The Milk Mob. I love that name. I could go on listing Anne's credentials, but I'd rather dive into her wealth of knowledge about breastfeeding. A number of years ago, I interviewed Anne on the show, and I'm very excited to have the opportunity to talk to her again. Welcome, Anne, to our show.
Well, thank you for having me, Corinne. I'm really excited to be here today.
Let's start with your background. Breastfeeding is obviously one of your passions. Tell us your story.
Well, I started on this journey when I put my first child to my breast in 1990, actually, and realized, oh my gosh, I forgot to learn about breastfeeding when I was in my residency. So I sought some help for some problems that I had, and I actually dug into a lot of literature through the library and found very little published literature on the clinical aspects of breastfeeding. But when I actually sought help from lactation consultants in Los Angeles, in my geographic area, I found that the assistance I received was not the same sort of care or the same quality of care that I felt as a family physician I would deliver. In other words, it wasn't delivered in the way that we are taught as family physicians to practice. So I decided I wanted to learn about this and learn how to help my patients. And fortunately, lactation consulting, that whole field of lactation, was just emerging in Los Angeles and California at that time. This was the area where the whole field of lactation was beginning. And so I was fortunate enough to be near a training program and became trained and met my colleague, Elizabeth Williams, where we sort of gained the strength and courage to begin an organization called the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine, and it just goes on from there.
No regrets.
No regrets. Well, yeah, no regrets, but certainly a lot of time committed to this whole field.
Well, all of our lives are affected by the unpredictable decisions and actions of our new president, and that seems to be engaging everyone in one form or another. So we may as well start with one of his more controversial goals, among many, which is to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. If that happened, how would that affect breastfeeding?
Well, the Affordable Care Act did one amazing thing for us back in 2012. At the time that healthcare was being reformed, the Institute of Medicine looked at a number of preventative services that would actually help boost public health in this country. The idea was to find services that would be 100% covered by insurances so that people didn't have to pay for them, and if they didn't have to pay for the services, then they would consume the services and it would better their lives and improve public health. So lactation services and paraphernalia or durable medical equipment, particularly breast pumps, were considered to be worthwhile services to be covered. And indeed, that was mandated. So in 2012, it was mandated that all insurance companies that were not grandfathered in had to cover lactation services and basically breast pumps with no cost sharing for families. And this became really a very popular mandate, although it did take a while for insurances to catch on to this, but it basically allowed women to have access to lactation services without having to pay for it, whereas it used to be that you needed to find your own resources and have your own money to just to find someone to help, given that in the whole medical field, people are not trained. So when people leave the hospital, they have to go find their own resources in the community. And by having it covered, they largely could get lactation consultants in the community covered with their insurance. So what ended up happening, and there was a recent study that was published just in November of 2016, showing that the outcome of this mandate was that we had an increase in breastfeeding rates in populations that typically had lower rates. So it preferentially boosted breastfeeding rates among African Americans, women who were not married, women who were poor, and women who had less education. And historically, those are groups that have lower breastfeeding rates.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think, again, these are groups that women who are uneducated tend to have less income. And, of course, if you have less income, you cannot afford lactation services or even to buy a pump. So before 2012, I would meet many women who would say, well, I know I should probably get a pump, but I really can't afford one. I'm not sure where to get one. And so insurance companies typically have been providing breast pumps to women, and that has made a huge difference. So I think that's part of it. I think also lactation consultants have made deals with insurance companies. They've become providers for insurance companies, and that's made it easier for them to sort of get the word out among people who have those insurances.
Do you think also that the Affordable Care Act gave more women access to prenatal care?
Possibly. I'm not sure about that. I don't know the statistics or the effect on prenatal care as a result of the Affordable Care Act.
I was thinking that maybe that would also increase the breastfeeding rates if there was some education before women had their babies.
Well, that's a really good point, because many of the initiatives that are being done involving prenatal care, particularly a movement called Centering Pregnancy, does emphasize the importance of breastfeeding and gives support and education for breastfeeding prenatally.
Well, doesn't breastfeeding come naturally? Why do we need so much education?
Well, that's a good question. I oftentimes answer that question by saying, well, look, when you have a daughter who's turning 9 or 10 and you can tell she's starting to have puberty changes, do you say, well, look, you know, you don't really need to know anything about menstruation because it's just natural. It's just going to happen. Well, of course not. We want every young woman to know what happens with the changes in her body, what happens with menstruation, how she becomes pregnant, how to prevent sexually transmitted diseases, blah, 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 you know, how to take care of her body and how to understand her body. And so although it's natural, historically, it's been our mothers, our aunts, our sisters who have helped us understand how breastfeeding works and the journey involved in breastfeeding. And now we've lost that. We've gone through a number of generations now, several decades, a century, basically, with very low and at times close to zero breastfeeding rates in some cultures. And so much of this information has been lost, and now we need to regain that. But education does have to be formal at this point. We just don't. Now, there are some cultures that do have that generational knowledge, where women are able to get that support from their families. But on the other hand, sometimes some cultural beliefs may not be quite as accurate and may lead to breastfeeding failure. And there are some medical problems with breastfeeding that even cultural norms may not be able to solve. And now we know so much more about breastfeeding, we can actually help to troubleshoot and diagnose and treat breastfeeding problems.
Such as?
Oh, such as things like low milk supply, recurrent mastitis, situations where women now, so many women have underlying health problems that impact breastfeeding. So, for example, if they have type 1 diabetes or if they have had a transplant and they're taking immunosuppressive medications, these women have special needs in terms of breastfeeding, and it takes someone who's a specialist in breastfeeding medicine to help them through problems that they may have.
And you're saying that these women can breastfeed?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are very few women who cannot breastfeed.
what women can't breastfeed?
So, you know, it's always funny when people say that, like, when can't they breastfeed? And, you know, breastfeeding just happens. You know, you deliver a baby, and guess what? Milk comes to the breast. So the question is, when should we encourage women not to breastfeed? Well, there are very, very few situations where they shouldn't breastfeed, primarily situations where they themselves need to be taken care of. So if a woman develops advanced cancer during her pregnancy or right before pregnancy, and it's known that she's going to need intensive chemotherapy, radiation, she needs to take care of herself, and we don't want chemotherapy be given to a breastfeeding mother, so it would be best for her not to breastfeed. Historically, women who have HIV were encouraged not to breastfeed, but now we know that if women are taking antiretroviral medication to really keep the HIV DNA down quite a bit so there's no viral particles, that she's able to breastfeed. So that contraindication has actually gone away.
What about hepatitis B and C?
So hepatitis is not a contraindication to breastfeeding. Women can breastfeed if they have hepatitis B and hepatitis C. And the reason for that is with hepatitis B, babies, assuming that they're immunized right away, right after birth, they're basically protected. And with hepatitis C, there's such a low transmission through breast milk, it's not felt to be a significant means of transmission of the virus to babies. So when women have hepatitis C, they're encouraged to breastfeed their babies. There are a few other contraindications, or what I mean is reasons to not breastfeed. One would be if a woman has active tuberculosis. And in that situation, she needs to be separated from her baby, but she can actually pump and give that express breast milk to the baby. She just needs to be away from the baby so she doesn't cough or sneeze on the baby and give the baby tuberculosis. And then women who are taking illicit medications such as heroin, PCP, methamphetamines, are instructed to not breastfeed just because of the lack of safety of these drugs in the baby's system. The one illicit, well, I guess kind of illicit, it's illicit here in Wisconsin, but I guess not in California now, is marijuana. There is definitely concern about marijuana during breastfeeding because these babies are basically stoned if they're receiving marijuana through breast milk. Marijuana has an affinity for breast milk because it likes fatty parts of our body. It likes to be stored in fat, and breast milk is full of fat. So babies do receive a fair amount of marijuana when mothers are ingesting marijuana. And there's been some concern about the infant's cognition during the time that the baby's exposed to marijuana. So the state of California, being sort of ahead of the game in terms of their public health messages regarding marijuana and pregnancy and lactation, have on their state health department website zero tolerance of marijuana during breastfeeding.
That's what you would tell a mom who came to your practice who was smoking marijuana?
I would encourage her to understand the risks, you know, that we don't want babies stoned because babies are so actively trying to form connections in the world, basically trying to form connections between all the things that the baby's experiencing through all of its different senses. And that ability to form those connections really is blunted. So I would encourage her to ingest minimal amounts and to not do that very often.
And perhaps as far away from breastfeeding as possible, even though it stays in the body a long time.
Right. That's the problem, because I think your typical dose of marijuana is going to, I think that the THC is going to hang around for at least 5 to 7 hours. So we'd want really low doses. Because babies nurse like every 1.5 to 2.5 hours, it's going to be hard to avoid feedings. I guess she could pump and dump during that time if she wanted to, if she felt like that was something she wanted to do. Then she couldn't give either donor milk or give formula. So that would be one option.
If you're just tuning in, this is Corinne Fregoni, and you're listening to Through the Eyes of Women. My guest today by phone from Wisconsin is Dr. Ann Iglesh, and we are talking about breastfeeding. We were talking about marijuana and the effect on babies, and that perhaps it's recommended that mothers do not smoke marijuana or ingest marijuana while they're breastfeeding, probably at all, while they're breastfeeding during that whole period, because it tends to stay in our body for such a long period of time. What about tobacco?
So women who smoke cigarettes can breastfeed. Certainly any exposure that infants have to cigarettes, whether it's mothers who are breastfeeding who are smoking or babies who are formula fed, where there are smokers in the home, all those babies have an increased risk of sudden infant death syndrome. So smoking is a very serious problem for babies. But women who smoke certainly can breastfeed. They struggle with their milk supplies. Cigarette smoking reduces the amount of fat in breast milk, and it also reduces her prolactin level, which is the hormone that comes from the brain that tells the breast to make milk. So many women will start out with a fairly good milk supply if they're cigarette smokers, but if they continue to smoke even half a pack a day, they'll find by 2 to 3 months that their supply is quite low and it's hard to keep up with the baby's needs. One piece of advice that we give women is that if they are going to smoke, let's say they smoke a couple times a day, to smoke right after they nurse, since the nicotine level will peak at around, just like within like 60 minutes or something. And so if they wait a couple hours to nurse again, then the level of nicotine will be down in their system. But I would say it's extremely important not to co-sleep with a baby when smoking cigarettes, because that the cotinine, which was one of the metabolic factors that, from nicotine, that gets excreted through the breath. So the baby's cotinine the metabolic factor from nicotine, that will rise during sleep if mom is breathing on the baby, and that increases risk of sudden infant death syndrome. So it's important that no one co-sleep with the baby who's a smoker.
You mean baby being in bed with mom?
Baby being in bed with mom, exactly, right.
But mothers, they wake up, they're tired, they just want the baby, they want to breastfeed the baby, they have the best of intentions, but to get up out of bed and pick up the baby and breastfeed and take it to a chair or recliner takes a lot of effort. So I'm sure a lot of mothers would rather have the baby next to them to feed during the middle of the night. What do you say to that?
So if we're not talking about, smokers anymore, just in general?
In general, right.
So the American Academy of Pediatrics just put out their statement about what we call co-sleeping or co-bedding. This was put out in 2016, and they've put out previous recommendations prior to this. In general, the recommendation in public health, in the medical field, tends to be to not have the baby in bed because of the risk of accidents, like rolling over, the baby getting caught between the mattress and the headboard, or smothered under pillows, or suffocating under blankets, things like that. Or if there are people in the bed who have like sleep apnea, who are under the influence of medications or alcohol, all of these pose risks for babies. However, we also know that many breastfeeding mothers will get more sleep if they have the baby in bed with them. So for mothers who find that their babies really only sleep well when the babies are in the bed, there are ways to make co-sleeping much safer. And I would encourage anyone to look at La Leche League's website, searching for Safe Sleep 7. And those are recommendations for a mother on how to be safe with the baby in the bed. And this is only applicable to babies who are breastfeeding, because babies who are breastfeeding have a much, much lower risk of sudden infant death syndrome than babies who are formula feeding. So co-sleeping with a formula-fed baby is not nearly as safe as co-sleeping with a breastfed baby. And so if a mother would like to co-sleep with her baby, then it would be important that the baby is lightly dressed and not caught under covers or not on top of a pillow. The baby should be on his or her back and not take the risk of getting caught between the mattress and the headboard or falling out of the bed. And no one in the bed should be under the influence of any substances that would make them less aware of the baby being there, and there should not be siblings in the bed as well. So anyone who has further questions about this should look at the Safe Sleep 7 by La Leche League.
I know one common complaint that I came across with mothers was that they felt that their milk supply wasn't strong enough, and they were worried about baby's weight gain. What do you tell moms about that?
I think it's important to understand that the best way to know if the baby's gaining well is to get a weight check. So oftentimes women will read about checking the number of stools and the number of voids, but babies can be tricky sometimes. Sometimes babies don't demand more calories, and sometimes babies will seem fussy and parents don't realize that the fussiness actually has to do with calories. So my suggestion is that whenever a mother has a concern about the baby's weight to be seen. And I guess the other half of that is that sometimes mothers perceive that they have a low supply and that the baby needs more calories, but in fact, her breasts are going through the normal changes of not overproducing as much as they did the first month, because the breasts do settle down over time. And when women feel like their breasts aren't as full anymore, they may think they're not making enough milk, but in fact, their bodies are just regulating to the baby's demands. So I think the best way to encourage mothers to keep breastfeeding and to feel very confident and to understand what's happening with their bodies is really to see the mother and the baby and to weigh that baby and make sure that baby's gaining appropriately according to growth curves, which is what we use in medicine to make sure babies are gaining well.
Let's go back in time. We're all mammals here. How and why did breastfeeding become so controversial? What's the history of breastfeeding among humans?
Well, it's so funny, you know, to think of it as controversial. I mean, it's like, how do we get here after, like, you know, hundreds of thousands of years? And every mammal breastfeeds, right, unless that's taken away from them because they're domesticated. But what ended up happening, first of all, for hundreds of thousands of years, even in the 1800s, people knew that if they didn't breastfeed their babies had a much higher risk of dying. And for a long time, people knew that if they gave their babies cow's milk or an animal milk instead of breastfeeding, well, they knew their babies were going to die. So for a long time, there were campaigns to make sure that women knew, that families knew that they needed to continue to breastfeed their babies. But around the turn of the century, around the end of the 1800s, with the Industrial Revolution, many women looked for work away from their babies in factories. And so they faced this dilemma of not having a means of making sure the babies received breast milk. And they used to hire wet nurses to feed their babies, but the wet nurses also took jobs in factories. So Nestle identified this back in the late 1880s, and he recognized that there was a need for some sort of substitute for breast milk for babies who didn't have access to their mother's own milk. And so he started making formula, and there was this perfect, like, sort of coup or the perfect storm, because at the same time, around the turn of the century, around, you know, 1900, the medical field was starting to take an interest in the whole field of pediatrics. Before that, the care of the infant was really in the hands of midwives, and it wasn't until they became like little adults that doctors would pay any attention to children. So around 1900, 1920, physicians started to become interested in becoming pediatricians and public health and the care of the infant. And guess what? They learned their nutrition from Nestle. And because that whole field of pediatric nutrition was just emerging, and you have these corporations that were actually taking an interest in it to try to understand what was in breast milk and how to make a formula that was similar. And so at around the 1920s is when pediatricians started thinking, well, gosh, we know exactly what's in formula, but we don't know what's in breast milk, so we should probably be promoting formula. So although formula started as a food that was meant to help breastfeeding infants survive, suddenly it took over breastfeeding. And this is at the same time that women also started delivering in hospitals rather than at home with midwives. So then in hospitals set up these systems of separating mothers and babies and giving feedings, like exact scientific feedings to babies, which would destroy the opportunity for mothers to breastfeed. So breastfeeding basically was not happening in the hospital, and if women didn't initiate breastfeeding in the hospital, well, guess what? They're not going to be successful when they leave. So it really had to do with the intervention of medicine in the natural process of caring for infants and the natural process of childbirth that greatly contributed to the destruction of breastfeeding in this country. And it wasn't until about the 1950s that La Leche League came together and was a grassroots movement to bring back breastfeeding that really made the difference and brought the rates back up towards the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Well, we're getting close to the end of our interview. I want to talk a little about your organization, the Milk Mob. I have spent hours studying your website. It is wonderful. It's fabulous.
Thank you.
It's so informative and so practical. And just any question that comes to mind about breastfeeding, you address at your website. It's an organization that you and your husband, Mitch, started. Tell us what your goals are and why you did this.
So I did this because there's been a great deal of emphasis in our country on education at the hospital level. So when women deliver, there's been a great deal of money, grant money, education towards how to get off to a good start. But once women leave the hospital with their breastfeeding babies, and now we're up to like 80 to 90% of women leaving the hospital with breastfeeding babies, they call their doctor's office, and guess what? No one knows anything. And so they have to go and find their own resources somewhere. So my feeling is that we need to work on outpatient breastfeeding education, not only for doctor's offices, but for other community supporters who tend to support breastfeeding women in one way or another, such as at WIC, public health nurses, home visitors, peer counselors, the mother-baby store, social workers, anyone who's working with these mothers. Basically, we're all asked the same questions. We're all, these breastfeeding mothers will have the same concerns and express the same concerns to all of us. Gee, I wonder if my milk supply is too low. My nipples hurt. I'm worried about how well the baby's growing. We all need to know the answers to those questions, and that's what the organization is dedicated to.
And you're doing a terrific job. I have one last question in the few seconds we have left. Do you know, in recent history, what U.S. presidents have been breastfed?
Well, I think that is under big wraps. We probably have to find out from the FBI or the CIA. I have no idea. Really, that information is not readily available. I do know that Obama was breastfed, and probably Jimmy Carter, because he was born at home, and perhaps presidents before him, because if presidents were born at home, they likely were breastfed. But I would bet that certain presidents were not breastfed.
We can maybe make some assumptions, but really you don't know.
I don't know.
Thank you, Ann, so much for all this information. I could keep going. There's so many questions I have, and I'm sure so many questions our audience has about breastfeeding. You give great answers, very practical, and also very compassionate and understanding. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. I really enjoy doing this.
You've been listening to Through the Eyes of Women. I'm your host, Corinne Fregoni. My guest today was Dr. Ann Eglash, and we've been talking about breastfeeding. To learn more about breastfeeding, you can go to the website that she and her husband developed called themilkmob.com. It's a fabulous resource for any questions you may have. Through the Eyes of Women is a collaborative voluntary team effort produced for KHSU located at Humboldt State University. Thanks to today's engineer and editor, Katie Whiteside. You can listen to the show again or to post listener comments, visit our blog at khsuwomen.com. Join us again next Monday at 1:30 right here on KHSU.